Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 249. I am Vincent Diamante, currently drinking some tea. Actually, I think this might be my fourth or fifth cup of black tea. The caffeine doesn't really hit me the way that it does some other people, but I like my black tea. And sometimes it's just like the plain old tea bags. Doesn't have to be the fancy stuff. But speaking of fancy stuff, we've got Alex May over here as well. How are you doing, Alex?
I guess I'm doing very fancifully. Thank you, Vince.
Excellent.
three. How many cups of black tea do you have a day?
It really depends. I am very inconsistent when it comes to my drinking habits. So sometimes I have a cup of tea in the morning and then that's it for the next 3-4 hours. Sometimes it's like today where I'll have, I think this is my fifth cup since this morning.
Okay. That's pretty heavy going. For myself, I absolutely love black tea as well. Just straight black Yorkshire tea or PG tips.
Oh, yeah.
And normally I have about 3 cups in the morning and that kind of does me for the rest of the day. And also sometimes if it's a particularly sleepy day, then I'll hit the jasmine tea after lunch. You know, if the old post lunch carbohydrate lethargy is strong, then that's when you break out the heavy duty industrial strength jasmine tea. But anyway, tea. Maybe let's gracefully segue into game audio, shall we?
Yeah, I mean, what is there to say except that sometimes I do need an energy boost before getting to work. But actually, I haven't been doing that much work lately because I've had a few weekends scheduled where I was going to partake in some fun, fanciful, recreational stuff because I like my games. And there was a game event that actually happened last week. Today is August 25th, and last weekend in Northern California was actually the annual California Extreme, which is a really, really fun event where people go ostensibly to auction off arcade game hardware.
Wow.
And traditionally the day before is that they put all of the wares on free play for people to have fun with before the auction actually happens.
Are we talking actual arcade cabinets?
Yes.
Amazing.
Hundreds and hundreds of arcade cabinets, pinball machines. I mean, it was, I don't think it's 1,000, but it could be close to there. Many hundreds of cabinets and pinball.
I mean, Vince, for anybody born in the 70s or 80s, I mean, the idea of going into a warehouse with hundreds and hundreds of arcade machines on free play. That's like heaven right there. That must have been amazing. Oh, what did you play? What did you see?
Everything. So there was a lot of let's go right to the beginning. They had 70s classics. Like if you wanted to play the original computer space, they had an original computer space, not like the refined Nolan Bushnell version that tried to simplify it, but the very old. Why would they arrange the buttons in these way and like just a single 1x5 button row of turn left, turn right, accelerate, teleport. It's so funny, you know, like all these things from the 70s and 80s where they were still trying to figure out the standards because there are in fact arcade standards that came out, like the JAMA standard for wiring, but that which also instated a standard for how a control panel should look, like the idea of the joystick being on the left and buttons on the right, for example. But that is a product of the mid 80s, and you know, you go here and there's a lot of stuff from the 70s and 80s. And we're just talking about the arcade cabinets. Once you go into pinball, they had all sorts of electromechanical stuff, pre-CPU type pinball designs, which were really fun to check out. The focus of California Extreme actually skews towards pinball, where I would say it's actually harder to get a play in on pinball because people are excited to play something like hey, there's a Elvira over there. Oh, hey, there's Black Knight 2000 right next to Black Knight before that and all that stuff. So there's all sorts of great pinball. But the arcade machines, those are really fantastic, too. You know, things like...
Can I rattle off some names and see if you saw them there?
Oh, please.
Okay. Tempest.
Yes.
Yes. Defender.
Yes.
Yes.
I saw two Defenders there, actually, because one one was a cocktail style.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Cool.
Yeah.
Was the Tempest actually have the like rotating paddle?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, amazing.
It was an original Tempest. Yes.
That's incredible. Okay. Then moving a bit later, how about Rastan Saga?
I actually didn't see that.
No? Okay. Do you know the game Rastan Saga?
I think so, but I have to remind myself which one that was. This game! Like, yes, I know this game, but I definitely did not see it there at the time.
Okay. How about Xevious?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay. What about... did they have any of the big sit-in Star Wars games?
They did. They had a couple of those, actually. It was really fun to see those, you know, the big sit-down with the Vector monitor up in front, and just, like, that style of play and the feeling of it is so different.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, let's see. What about... moving a bit later, what about Raiden?
Oh, yes. There were a few different Raidens there.
Okay, cool. And let's see. Twin Cobra?
No, I didn't see that.
No Twin Cobra. Okay. Any of the Street Fighter machines? I guess there must have been.
Oh, yeah. Those were easy to come across. Actually, there were many of them. And just going through the whole series, even some of the not-so-fun stuff, like Street Fighter the movie, the game, with the digitized actors from the game. Like, so if you want to play as, you know, Ming-Na Wen as Chun-Li, you know, that's a thing.
And then what about, they have 1942?
Yes, they did. They had a couple of different versions of that. Actually, besides the arcade stuff, there were also other rooms upstairs. So, there was actually a room with some console stuff. And again, it was focused on some more niche indie stuff. So this one, for example, was a port of 1942 for the Atari 2600. Which was, you know, just pretty weird when you think about it, because the Atari 2600 is really weak hardware. But there's also a community of people, of just indie guys that want to see what can be done with the 2600 hardware. And you know, I mean, we think about 1942, it's such a simple game, but there are so many sprites moving around the screen that you can't really do that on that hardware without some help. You know, so other later systems like the Intellivision or the Atari 7800, for example, came out in the mid-80s, like that's designed to like properly do that hardware, that arcade hardware that was good at manipulating all those sprites around the board. The 2600, that thing needed some help. But you could see weird stuff like that, or you know, other indie games, you know, people that are in this day and age making things for the 7800 or the Atari Jaguar or brand new Sega CD games, you know, fun stuff like that. Going back to the arcade cabinets, they had some other prototype arcade games like Primal Rage 2. You know, back in that fighting game era, everyone wanted to make a fighting game, and Atari made a game called Primal Rage, which was somewhat popular. You play as dinosaurs and, you know, just sort of biting the crap out of each other. They mostly made a Primal Rage 2 game. It was mostly complete. It's really playable, and you can find these prototype boards all around California, and this collector actually had one up for auction.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Like, on so many levels, though. I mean, so the actual objective of the event is what? Is it for, like, buying and selling arcade cabinets? Is that the actual objective? Or is it just like a hobbyist sort of come together and enjoy, you know, this legacy of video games?
I think it's skewing more that way. So the first California Extremes, which were about 20-some years ago, they were very much focused on auctioning stuff and hey, let's trade stuff here and there. Nowadays, it's actually much more on, hey, let's have fun and excitement here. And so there were plenty of machines where it would have a little sticker on it that said, yeah, provided by such and such person, not for sale, which would actually make me feel a little bad because, I mean, I really shouldn't be buying arcade machines. But since I have a house and a garage, I have that temptation. Maybe I should actually get an arcade machine. So,
I mean, what would you get, though? I mean, with so much choice and so many classics, what would you choose?
That's a good question. There were some really weird ones that I saw.
I think for me, while you're thinking, it would have to be either Tempest.
Tempest is maybe, really good.
Yeah, Tempest just, it's such a complete concept and it's so innovative. Like, it's like, how would you think of that? You know, the idea that to create this tunnel and you're kind of rotating your kind of funny little C-shaped kind of gremlin around the circumference of the top of the tunnel, and you have these things coming up inside the tunnel, and then you know how you get these spikes that form at the end of the tunnel, and then when you warp you have to be at the right position so you don't get hit by the spikes. It's just so brilliant with working with so little, not to mention the sound, of course, which is just, you know, incredible. For me it'll be either Tempest or Xevious. Just because of the sound in Xevious is so cool. Mm. That just constant arpeggio that's going.
Oh yes, yes.
It's like, for some reason, that doesn't become annoying. Maybe it's like a nostalgia thing.
It's not annoying. It's totally iconic. Actually, I remember. Yeah. What was it? Actually, I remember that sound hitting me a couple years back. It wasn't. Oh, I remember now. So I was playing this game called Ace Combat Infinity, and it's in the Ace Combat series, but it's actually not particularly well regarded, mostly because it was one of those free-to-play games where you have to it had this whole system of, oh, you have to purchase fuel in order to fly out. Anyways, it's an Ace Combat game, so it's a 3D action arcade flight simulation type game. And while I was playing the game, in the middle of this mission, which usually lasts about 15 to 30 minutes, I suddenly hear that sound. And then I'm like, what the hell is that sound? And while I'm flying, I see some crazy rotating triangles, just like, not triangles, rectangles, just sort of flying through the air at me. And I'm like, what the hell? Why is this going? Like, well, I hear this sound, and then there are those crazy... What are those called? You know what I'm talking about. Those rotating rectangle things that come at you in Xevious.
Yeah, I know. They're like big saucers, big kind of flying saucers, right?
Yeah, but yeah, that I was like, oh, why are these coming at me? What the hell? And then I realized, oh, it's Namco. It's from Xevious. It's at Ace Combat, and that was the connection. They put in this Easter egg where, like, if you do, like, some particular set of mission goals, then these things would suddenly show up. It was the weirdest thing in what was otherwise an arcadey, but also very realistic-looking flight sim.
So, yeah. Xevious had the best, you know, the shot sound, and when you hit, it always the first, you know, the first few minutes when you're just shooting at the kind of these, like, rotating discs that are coming at you.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got this kind of... did it sound like that? And then the bomb, of course, which is it's just so good. I guess for the nostalgia factor, the third machine that I would bring home with me would probably be 1942. And again, 1942 was the first time that I saw, I heard the potential of what sound can do for a video game. Because I don't know if you remember, I think I might have mentioned this on the show, like, I don't know, 100 episodes ago, but in 1942, when you start, first the plane takes off from the carrier, and then you get this kind of sound like that. Yep. And I used to believe that something about that sort of Morse code kind of sound would cue what's coming at you. And, of course, it doesn't. It's just, it's the same every time you play it. But, like, I can remember being so sort of, convinced.
Convinced,
I was just convinced that this was like some kind of cue from the audio that something, you know, if I could only understand what that meant, it would tell me, like, I don't know, like, you know, five green planes coming from the right side or something like that. It's a really neat kind of the inclusion of that is just, it's such a neat little thing because it just shows you that, you know, sometimes you can, the sound designers or the sound of the game can lead the way. You don't actually have to have something happening on screen that would, you know, cue, oh, that sound is coming from there. You know, it doesn't have to be that way. You can just have the sound, you know, lead that kind of design concept entirely independently and autonomously from the game design itself. And I think 1942 was the first game that actually did that where I really noticed. And then, yeah, it was like a kind of some kind of voodoo magic thing where I came to believe that, okay, the sequence of those Morse code blips would tell me something about what's coming.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. It's so distinct. There's clarity to it. It feels really intentional beyond just like the musical rhythm of it. And so I totally get why you would feel that way.
So what is your which one of these arcade games would you bring home then, Vince?
Man, let's see. I got to go ahead and say what's a machine that I would not bring home. So one of the machines was a Street Fighter machine. And I tried playing that game and I realized, oh my God, I cannot play this game. Now, of course, I can play Street Fighter. This was Street Fighter 3 Third Strike, which is a more than 20-year-old game, now that I think about it. I don't want to think about that. but more importantly, it actually had a different control panel than I was expecting. So it had a very American-style control panel, by which I mean the gate for the joystick was a smooth circular gate. It didn't have corners that you can hit.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And also, the buttons were American style in that they were concave rather than convex. So your fingers sort of sit in it.
Yes, yes, I know what you mean.
It's just different. You know, that little bit of difference got in the way of me hitting my combos the way I want to, or hitting my dragon punch motions, where the motion is sort of like a right to down, and then you end on that corner down right before you hit a button. Because there's no notch there in the corner, it was really hard for me to feel how to hit that motion properly. And then just my fingers, it was actually really frustrating to me playing that game with the mismatch of that control panel. So I wouldn't get that machine, but there were definitely some other interesting machines that I would get. Probably Blockout. I gotta get Blockout, which is imagine Tetris except it's 3D,
right?
And it's great. It had three buttons on there so you can rotate on X, Y, and Z axis before you drop a piece away from you into the screen, and you clear rows by clearing them the way that you expect, filling it in completely with no holes, just like the original Tetris. But it's 3D, and I love just getting back into, can I get my brain to wrap around this concept? It's just so fun that way. I totally get that it's not easy like Tetris or various other puzzle games that are there, but I like also pushing myself in that way too. So that was really fun to play. Cool. What else?
Virtua Fighter 2?
I mean, So many of these games are like available on console too, and they're really good. I do own one arcade game right now, and it's Afterburner Climax, which is a Sega game. And the reason I own it is because you cannot buy that game anymore on modern or old hardware. If you're lucky, you might have an old Xbox 360, which still has the game downloaded. But who knows when that thing will go, because consoles are, you know, they're not permanent. But I have this arcade cabinet with a working arcade board and the control system. It's great. So like having a game that is not quite what you can get just with modern hardware, you know, even right. Street Fighter, I love fighting games, but you can replicate 99% of that experience at home with a good quality joystick, or, you know, if you're really a stickler, you can get an old school CRT display instead of an LCD and stuff like that.
In that case, I think you'd have to go with one of the vector games like Battlezone or Tempest, or, you know, one of those games. Battlezone is obviously Tempest has the rotating paddle, so you're not going to get that.
Which I love. Yeah, anything with a rotary encoder for a control is really cool. I really love that stuff.
Maybe like Missile Command as well, because they used trackballs for that, didn't they? And that also wouldn't be able to be easily replicable if you didn't have the cabinet.
They had a missile. They had one of those actually over there, and it was really fun to play that. And just remembering, wow, the weight and slight inertia of the rotational inertia of the ball as you trying to get over to the right place. And you got to be both precise and quick. It's like, oh right, I get it. This was a really fun physical motion to engage in. Man, maybe Missile Command, actually. That's there.
Games, you know, the games that had the top of the joystick would rotate to actually rotate, like the top-down shooters, like Heavy Barrel is one that comes to mind.
Yes, they had Heavy Barrel there, actually.
Cool.
That's
another classic game audio, iconic game audio moment when you collect all the parts of the Heavy Barrel gun and he goes, Heavy Barrel, like that.
Okay, there were some problems with that machine because I was not hearing sound at all while I was playing that game. It's too bad.
Anyway.
But, Heavy Barrel, that could be a good one. Time Soldier had a similar thing going on with the rotary stick. What else? It was actually kind of fun playing stuff like Virtual Lawn.
I
mean, you can play that on modern hardware, but having the full two-stick, you know, bespoke control for that game, So there were some fun stuff. I think probably my favorite things to play there were the games that weren't released. So things like Primal Rage 2. There was another game that was really crazy called Danger Express, which was somewhere. It was kind of like Narc, with digitized actors, you know, you just sort of run around and beat people up, but you're doing it with these digitized actors and it feels absolutely ridiculous.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that in itself, this happens once a year. Cause if it does, I better get over there for the next one. Cause this sounds amazing.
I think you should. You would totally get a kick out of this. It happens every year. You do have to go to Northern California. And it's always around this time, like July or August. Right. So if you ever find yourself up here, you know, I will definitely hang out with you and make that trip as well.
That sounds amazing. Actually, as we record this, we have Gamescom going on in Germany, which is one of the, if not the largest consumer and developer focused gaming events in Europe. Essentially a little point of discussion there that I thought we could talk about, because I was checking out a Eurogamer article, which was like a summary of all of the major announcements that came from the first night, where they had, you know, these big arena showing trailers from upcoming games. And in this Eurogame article, it just sort of went through, I don't know, about 15 to 20 trailers from notable titles that are coming from the more famous studios. And of course, you've got all of the ones that are drawing a lot of attention at the moment, such as Bethesda's Starfield and the new Phantom Liberty expansion for Cyberpunk. And these are all, I actually am not ashamed to admit that I have already purchased both of those, so I don't really know how my time is going to be divided between them, but I'm really looking forward to both Phantom Liberty and Starfield. But there was something that I noticed, and I actually ended up writing to you about it because I was so perplexed. There's something that I've noticed about the way that trailers are mixed, the sound mixing for trailers from certain... It usually tends to be certain Japanese game studios. And in this case, Tekken was one of them. And there was what's called Grand Blue Relink, I think.
Relink.
Yeah, and a few other like Japanese titles in there. And the first thing you notice when you're going through like a list of trailers from an event like that, they really stand out because at first blush, it sounds like they're mixed really badly. So firstly, it sounds mono, where everything else, like the sort of the, you know, the standard Western trailers, they're usually like super wide. But in this case, it's definitely right up the middle. It's all mono, which means when you're listening to it on headphones or on a speaker system, a small speaker system, immediately these just sound terrible. It's like, oh, they sound just flat and like really, you know, there's no energy and it just sounds really bad. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I noticed was that the VO tended to be quite hard to discern, usually because it's mono, everything's right up the middle, and therefore, you know, everything's bunched up in the middle and you can't really sort of hear. Normally in a stereo mix, you know, much of the music information will be out on the side and they're leaving some space in the middle for, you know, the key things that you want to be listening to, like percussion or voiceover and stuff. But no, like everything's right at the middle, hard to hear what the characters are saying. And then the third thing is that the sound effects tend to be extraordinarily high in the mix. So, if you go through, if you have a look at this article, if you go to Eurogamer and look at like whatever it was called, like a summary of everything announced on the first night of Gamescom, I think was the name of the blog article. And you go, if you scroll through them, you'll see what I mean immediately when you get to some of these Japanese game trailers. They just sound horrible compared to the Western ones, which and not just Western ones, but also the Chinese studios and the Korean studios seem to be mixing the same as the Western studios, so big, fat, wide, you know, dynamic mixes. And then the Japanese ones are all flat and mono and badly mixed, and you just can't really understand what's going on. And I was so perplexed by it that I wrote to you, didn't I? Vince, do you have any idea what could be going on here? Because with some of these studios like Bandai Namco and, you know, there's no way that they are doing this just because they don't know how to mix a trailer. Like, it's absolutely impossible to conceive that a company like Bandai Namco would not have, you know, the top people working on their trailers for something like Tekken, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to get your work experience intern to come and mix Tekken for you, are you? Yeah, of course, no disrespect to any work experience or interns out there. But my point being... they're definitely going to have, you know, they're going to be bringing their A game to their trailer for an event like this, right? So
First impressions.
Exactly. So there must be a reason for it. And my hypothesis was, is it something to do with the fact that maybe they're mixing for this large venue? You know, it's like for this like really, really large venues, an arena kind of playback. You don't really know what kind of system it's going to be. You don't know how wide the stereo field is going to be, so it's always safer to mix at least the low end, if not the entire mix, in mono, just so that it can be punchy and strong, regardless of where in the arena that you're sitting. And if you happen to be right off on the side, you might get all of the left channel and none of the right channel, and that's going to sound pretty bad.
That's true.
But if you're mixing in mono, then everybody's going to get a consistent, you know, loud, punchy kind of mix in mono across that big PA speakers in a large arena. And actually, yeah, you confirmed that that seems to be the case, right?
Yeah, it is a little weird. Gamescom, definitely those trailers that are coming there. It seemed like the feed was a mono version of that trailer. But then I guess either a few hours later or maybe a day later, it seems like some of those trailers would drop on the official channel, whether it be Psygames, for example, for that Grand Prix Fantasy game, or Bandai Namco for Tekken. You go there and the trailer is, oh, this sounds like it's properly mixed. It sounds like, oh, there's a nice stereo field, the music and the sound effects, they sound good. And then the VO is in the right place as well as the right level relative. It is kind of funny that it ends up that way. And maybe it is just a matter of being extremely, extremely safe for that Gamescom venue.
Mm. I mean, I really want to believe that that's the case, because when I was so perplexed by it, I had to believe that there was a strong reason that they would, like, they intentionally making the decision to do it that way. Because when you scroll through a list of trailers on a blog post, you know, the ones that are mixed in mono when you're listening on your headphones or on studio speakers like I have or whatever, if you're not in a big arena and you're watching just one trailer after the next trailer, the next trailer, next trailer, next trailer, the ones that stand out as being really flat and kind of dull are the ones that are in mono. Yeah. And that's why, I couldn't believe that it would be because, in Bandai Namco don't know how to make a trailer. Of course they do. Of course this has to be an intentional choice. And so, yeah, I was somewhat relieved to find that, I posted you the article, and then you posted me the links from the official channels of the trailers that I had mentioned that seemed to be in mono. And I was very relieved to find that, when you go to the official release for consumers who are viewing at home or on their phones or whatever, then it's in stereo and it sounds great. Right. So, I guess I was worried that the Japanese trailers were somehow falling behind, but actually it seems like they're one step ahead.
Maybe?
I don't know.
It did make me think about how difficult it can be to mix for these venues, because like these... I haven't been to Gamescom, but I imagine it's not the same as, you're in a movie theater. It's designed for people to actually look at a screen and consume that, and that's it. So my only experience with something like that would be over at GDC, where all of these events that would be happening are happening at the Moscone Convention Center, and they're all ostensibly meeting rooms and you have to go in there and do things. So one example that I know of is Epic, when they were presenting Unreal 5 related material for the first time. And this stuff would be going out to the net, sure, but it would first be going to that audience, and they really wanted it to actually sound good. So they were actually booking those rooms the week before GDC actually happened, so that they know how that thing sounded like and were actually mixing to that room, because they wanted to make sure that these Unreal 5 presentations were actually presented properly to that particular audience, who were, very important developers and publishers that would be interested in Unreal 5 technology. So making sure that it actually sounds the best there. But I imagine that some of these companies are like, well, we just want this trailer to be put out there. Let's be safe. Let's just make a mono mix and we'll put it over those arena speakers. Maybe it's some crazy, line array thing for the whole space, or maybe it's just going to be a couple of speakers on the left and a couple of speakers on the right to fill the whole arena. Let's be safe. Maybe that really is the case.
That's really cool how Epic were mixing for the room that they were going to play the trailer in. That's really, really cool. Well, are the The joys of working in the AAA space, eh? Where you can do, you can just call up the Moscone before GDC and say, "Hi, it's Alex from Epic. Yeah, can we just borrow your room for a few hours? We want to mix in it."
Yeah. I mean, amazing. I think, you know, if you've got that time and, you know, it's really, really important, then yeah, let's do that. I haven't done that specifically, but like a few years ago, I was privy to things that would happen for these Apple presentations. So I knew that we would have this trailer. It would play in this amphitheater. We're going to deliver this format, and we know that the speaker arrangement is going to be like that. Bam, bam, bam. Cool. Which is different from worrying about everyone or worrying about an unknown space. You know, in this case, right. I was like, oh, wow, we got a pretty nice setup here. I can be very full. I could have dynamic range. I could have everything. You know, and that was cool, especially with what we wanted. We wanted to work that dynamic range all the way from just the barest environmental sound all the way to, okay, sound effects and, you know, lush music and everything is going on at the climactic point. Right. It was really cool to be able to know that I could deliver that and that that would be effectively presented there in that space.
I think that the balancing of, for example, even that original Tekken trailer that was in the Eurogamer article from the announcement night, because the balance is so unusual, it's so basically imbalanced when you listen to it, and being at all in mono, and as I said, the VO seems buried somewhere,
and the
sound effects are disproportionately loud. It does make me wonder whether, for example, at Bandai Namco, maybe they did actually take their mix to some kind of large arena and try it out and realize that, oh, actually, like if we do it the way that we normally would just for consumption on YouTube or whatever, you know, look, now the voices are way too loud and you can't hear the sound effects. And, you know, sitting on the left side is different from sitting on the right side. And maybe that's what kind of gave them that those cues for mixing it that way. I would sort of have to assume that in a large arena, they would probably, because they're going to be just taking just trailers that are designed more for YouTube than for arena broadcast, I would imagine that the PA people would probably sum everything to mono anyway, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, if like that was not, you know, that was not really Namco's delivery. That was the feed after they do a fold down there just in the space, you know, in the live board that they've got. And then it's just going straight to whatever streaming boxes they have. That's what I imagine, because if it was another, if I was Namco, if I was putting myself in their shoes, I'd be like, okay, you do want this in mono, you want to be conservative. There would be other things that I would want to do as well. You know, things like, how am I going to do things with the voices? Because so much of, say, a fighting game is cluing in people to these characters and just having a little bit of their voice. Oh, we know that, we know that these guys are coming back. We know that, you know, these characters are coming back and, you know, they have these very distinct voices. You know, Tekken's actually really interesting because they always have voice actors speak in their language, you know, if you go back to like the old fighting games where everyone is speaking Japanese despite being ostensibly from France or Russia or Brazil or whatever, you know, it's actually a little bit different in Tekken because they have this really big kind of elaborate and insane world building going on. You know, so all these characters are speaking these languages and you would want that voice to really be clear, because saying that a character is coming back, which is effectively what's going on from that little half second snippet of voice, is way more important than, oh, the big mass of sound effects and music that could be there and overlapping with that voiceover. So I would imagine that Namco really wasn't that responsible for that mono mix that came out of the Gamescom feeds that made it up onto YouTube.
Yeah, one thing I have to say though, like it's really, really fantastic how the sound design, the quality of sound design, especially in the games coming from Northeast Asia, like from China and Korea and Japan. It's interesting in these bad mixes because the sound effects are weirdly high in the mix. You can really hear them very, very clearly. And yeah. So many of these games, like the just the quality of the sound design, the detail, and then the connection between the visual and the sound are just next level. They're absolutely fantastic. And just makes you realize, you know, we are it's just great, you know, listening to you just get all really excited about game audio. And it's like, man, we do good work as like a as a game audio, an international community of game audio professionals that we are. Like the stuff that, that we're doing these days in video games, just the what we can bring to the experience through the sounds, it's just so cool. I mean, just some of these, go through and have a listen to some of those Northeast Asian games. There's a Korean one there called, I can't remember it now, but anyway, just fantastic. Like some of the sound design is just next level. Just fantastic. Personally, yeah. This is going to probably not going to earn me too many fans. But personally, for my own personal tastes, and this is just entirely my opinion, and please don't hate me, but personally, I tend to gravitate towards, when it comes to music, I tend to gravitate towards music producers in the West versus our Northeast Asian counterparts. However, when it comes to sound design, it's like, man, I just love listening to their work. It's just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's something really interesting about that, you know, clarity that comes there. And there's like this focus on the clarity of the design, the sort of distinct musicality, a very distinct musicality, where sometimes I think sound effects in the West, and I don't want to generalize too much, but it feels like it wants to meld too much into the other components that are there, whether it be the music, right, the ambient sound design, whatever.
Right.
Like, you know, I've always appreciated that clarity because I feel like that clarity isn't just, oh, it's a sound effect. Like that is a space for being able to say something that is perhaps more detailed than it might initially say for the newcomer to the game.
You know, exactly. So
like, okay, what can I do there? What can I do in terms of the shape, in terms of the sound, the pitch, the movement of the sound in order to say something that's worth saying? Or
I totally agree. And it's something that I learned when I was living in Japan. And it's actually interesting that when my wife is Japanese, and when my wife hears my work, her approach to sound effects in the West, I think that there is a tendency for us to get hung up a little bit too much on the connection between sound and realism. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to make the sound of like a robot arm moving, then, oh, okay, well, in that case, let's break this down. So it's got to have like servo motors, and it's got to sound metallic, and you've got to hear the resonance inside the metal chassis of the. But then maybe it's heavy metal, so it's got to resonate this way. And, you know, it tends to be, we approach it, well, maybe I shouldn't say we, I approach it sometimes too much from that side. Like I'm thinking way too physical in order to be creative, and often a bit scientific. Whereas what's really interesting, I find when I talk to my wife about sound effects or when she hears what I'm doing, her approach, and this is not just unique to her, but certainly when I was working in Japan as well, the Japanese game developers and the clients that we had when we're talking about sound effects and when they're criticizing the sound effects work that I would do, often the comments come from a direction that is totally metaphysical. Like it's not physical or scientific at all. It's like, this needs to sound more bright, or, you know, this needs to sound more like, you know, shilling, 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 like that. Or, you know, this part needs this is too dark here. We need to sound, you know, more fluid, or this part has to be juicy, or, you know, this part has to be kind of abrasive, or things like that. There's much more metaphysical in their just sort of conceptualization and discussion of sound. Maybe maybe this whole physical scientific approach is actually not the West-East divide. Maybe it's just me. So I might have just completely embarrassed myself there for all the other sound designers listening, thinking, yeah, of course, Alex, that's how you really need to be doing it, not approaching a robot arm with thinking about servo motors and metallic resonance, but actually about, you know, the feeling and the emotion that you want to convey from doing that.
Right.
But that, I feel like the when I listen to Japanese sound design, some of the sounds just sound ridiculous into when you approach it from a realism point of view, but their command of that metaphysical and emotional connection with sound effects is just masterful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that there's so much space to play there because, quite honestly, most of the game, well, it really does depend on the game, but for many games, the game really doesn't exist in the space, in the real space that's in front of you, whether it be on the screen or even what's presented in the speakers for us in audio. Like, so much of the game is actually in our mind. And how well does what is there actually mesh with that game? Because while you're playing the game, that's being calculated by your processors and memory and those algorithms that are running and shuttling that data back and forth, there's also the game that's playing in your mind. And it could be something that's happening on a moment-to-moment basis because you're a pro-level fighting game player and you're actually trying to predict things as they happen there. Or it could be happening on a much longer time period where even as you're playing something simple like a 90s role-playing game and your party is on the brink of defeat there as represented on the screen, but then there's that version of that that actually exists in your brain. And that's what I like to think about. Like, can you make the sound that actually is the proper accompaniment for that version of the game that actually exists in your mind just as much or maybe even more so than the game that is represented in the visual on that screen in front of you?
Yeah, I think a perfect example of that, basically, yeah, fighting game sounds from the Japanese fighting games, the classic ones, they're a really good example, I think, because, you know, a punch sound or like the classic example, which is just ridiculous when you think about it, but works so well in the context of the game, is in Virtua Fighter, when you jump on characters that are on the ground, you get this big kind of anvil sound.
It's like the clang.
Like, yeah, clang. It's like a big metal sledgehammer on an anvil, and it's just totally ridiculous. But in that moment, when you flick the joystick up and press kick, and the character does this jump and then lands on top of on a downed opponent, you know, that kind of ding kind of sound. It's just it's so satisfying. And it's the same with like punch and kick sounds as well from these games. Like that, you know, if you listen to a boxer going at it punching bag. That's it.
Yeah.
How could I forget punching bag? Anyway. When you listen to a boxer going out on a punching bag, it sounds nothing like what it sounds like in a fighting game, where it's more like a snare drum, like a distorted snare drum. But again, that's like you say, that's what you want to hear when you're playing those things. That's sort of the. I always viewed it a little bit differently from what you said. Maybe it's the same, arriving at the same direction, but when it comes to sounds where you're trying to elicit. When it comes to sounds where you don't need to be so faithful to what it looks real, so what matches how it looks, I always kind of just think of it comes down to just sort of feeling as good as possible. And sometimes what feels good isn't necessarily what is actually, you know, acoustically realistic for what it looks like. Maybe it could actually be exaggerated in one direction or the other or understated, you know. And that tends to be when you head into that area of the metaphysical and the what you're imagining as opposed to what it looks like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's so many ways to think about sound design. You know, I do want to say, though, that approaching it from that pure physical standpoint makes a lot of sense, especially when you're working with really large teams and you have so many things, so many moving parts that are actually happening. And it's worth actually trying to hit all of these elements faithfully. You know, hey, right. We're in a big open world environment. There are all these objects that need sound. And, you know, just imagining, hey, there's like 50 different objects that you could interact with in this room that you're in. Do you want 50 sound designers that are perhaps being extremely subjective with the sound design of those objects when you interact with them?
Right.
So maybe when you're dealing with them, you might want to direct them in a way that says, let's try to stick to more objective reality in this space. But right. You could also have really, really tight direction, really tight connection and vision and movement as a team towards a really interesting place that goes beyond just, the standard predictable objective reality that's in that space.
Yeah, that's true. I think in my own case, I often tend to fall back to starting off with the physical scientific approach, the acoustic approach to working out how something should sound, because mostly at the moment I'm mostly doing VR games, and prior to VR games I was doing mobile games, and so in all of these cases, like ultra realism, visual realism isn't often a luxury that you would have in VR or in mobile games. And so having sounds that can kind of ground the player to help them understand, oh, I see what this is. This is that. Even though potentially in VR, it may look a little bit, lower resolution, or maybe there won't be so much fancy shadows and shaders going on just because of trying to keep the frame rate up. And process a hit down, you often rely on the sound to help do some of that heavy lifting with regard to creating that realism. Maybe that could be the reason why I often tend to approach sound design from that angle, or also maybe because I like to actually construct sounds from scratch instead of trying to, if I needed a robot servo sound, I'd rather make one myself instead of just going to, some sound library and grabbing some servo motor sounds.
I think so, synthesizing that stuff is really cool. Just being able to, actually connect things in a really precise way to everything that's going on, the machinations of the game. It's really nice doing that versus, what you were just saying. Oh, what if I take this piece of Foley that's been recorded in this library and slap it on there? Like that feels like the wrong way to do it, even though it can work in places.
Yeah, I had that actually today. Yesterday and today, I've just been working on some laser gun sounds, and I'm synthesizing everything about four or five instances of Yuhi, one of my favorite Yuhi synths, which is Budzeel. Actually, it's not one of my favorite. It is the favorite for me. Pretty much everything I do is Budzeel. It's a sort of a modular, dragging cables around kind of basically a FM synth. But anyway, yeah, that was one situation where, because I'm synthesizing every part, it for me, making a laser gun sound from scratch, it just made sense to think of it from a science, like a physical point of view. Okay, let's imagine that, okay, now we've got maybe some kind of pressure valve, which is releasing some gas here. And then you've got some kind of, plasma converter, whatever, that is inverting something, which is creating this kind of sound inside here, but it will be in this shaped chamber. Therefore, it should resonate like this. And then as this energy ball or whatever leaves the chamber, it comes out of the end and produces this kind of sound, and then synthesizing each one of those parts following those sort of realism principles fortunately resulted in this particular case of in a laser gun sound that sounds somewhat unique, somewhat interesting, not just the usual pew pew kind of thing, but then also totally synthesized somewhat realistic at the same time. So, obviously there is a time and a place for all kinds of different approaches. But my point really was at the beginning of this discussion was that it's so inspiring often to see the Korean and the Japanese and the Chinese games just taking sound design like to the next level. I just love it. It just sounds so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Speaking of sounding good, let's get into some conspicuous consumption. That is the part of the show where we just do a quick round the table, or in this case, across the table, or across the virtual table, because we're not actually sitting across from a table, though that would be nice to do one day.
One day.
Just to see what kind of inspiring media or music or movies or books or TV shows or plugins or games, of course, that we've been consuming recently. So, Vince, other than hundreds of incredibly iconic classic arcade games, is there anything else that you've been consuming since the last show?
Okay, well, I've actually been playing with two things recently. I'll start off with the game, which is this PlayStation 1 game, which I'm actually holding the box for it in my hand. It's called The Pro Res 2. It's a Japanese pro wrestling game that was part of the Simple 1500 series, and okay. Which means that it was sold for a beautiful price, 1500 yen, which is not a lot of money. It basically is the equivalent of 10 bucks, 10 US dollars. And it's a pro wrestling game for the PlayStation 1. And if you know anything about the PlayStation 1, you know, okay, that was kind of limited at that time. Like, pro wrestling games really started to come into their own with the PlayStation 2 and the Xbox at that time, just because, oh, there was so much you could do in terms of things like character likenesses and licensing them properly, you know, really representing them in a modern game. This not so much, you know, everything was kind of wimpy, but it's also really cool seeing what was possible with those limitations, with, you know, kilobytes instead of megabytes when it came to sound effects. You know, it was actually really fun. And actually, going back to the point that you were making earlier about sound design, you know, this is a Japanese game. They really try to make very expressive sounds, even with that very, very limited space for all of these impacts, because there's so many different types of impacts, you know, bouncing off the ropes, bouncing against the mat, you know, all sorts of elaborate running and jumping and whatnot. And it's hard enough to convey the nuance of that with megabytes of space.
Right.
Doing it in kilobytes? Okay. It's actually really fun checking out these games and seeing how they worked with those limitations. And I thought they did it pretty successfully, especially considering it was a game very explicitly made to a price point. You know, this was made by one of those, you know, contract developers that, okay, you want us to make a wrestling game? I think we can make a wrestling game. Let's do it. We got our budget. We got our time. Let's hit this. And they hit it actually pretty well. So yeah, The Pro Res 2. That's the game that I've been playing. But
okay.
I've actually put that away because lately I've been trying to compare some software plugins that I have with some real hardware that I have. So I just shared a picture there that you could look at on Discord. I was always looking down on this piece of gear, so I never actually noticed that particular knob goes to 11. And now that I actually put it up as I'm sort of rearranging things, it's like, oh, it actually goes to 11. That's very funny.
For listeners who aren't seeing what I'm seeing, this is a picture of, it's your SSL Fusion preamp.
Is it? Yep.
Yeah. And Vince has sent me a photo of the drive circuit, vintage drive. There's a drive and a density knob. And sure enough, the drive knob goes to 11.
I thought it was funny.
That's great.
It's also kind of funny just how good the plugin is. Like, I've been trying to do some things with testing these things out, and, you know, can I actually do double blind? It's really hard. But basically, I'm listening to these things back and forth, and I think, oh man, the plugin's really close. Do I necessarily need to have the hardware? Because I do like the hardware, but the plugin is really close. So, yeah, I'm going to be playing around with that. But maybe I'll do some more testing, but like testing in the field as I do some more work. But yeah, that's what I'm having fun with. How about you, Alex?
I mean, that's really cool, actually. That's like the perfect, again, another flawless, seamless segue, Vince, into what I've been consuming actually today. So I got I was working today and I got a email newsletter notification from SoftTube talking about this weekend's deals, and in there for $39. Sadly, I think when this episode gets dropped, the sale will be over. But right now, I guess, Vince, you're the only person in the entire world who could benefit from knowing this right now if you didn't already subscribe to SoftTube's newsletter. But right now, the Celestion Speaker Shaper is on sale for $39. So this is a... So I bought it, and basically what I've been consuming not so conspicuously is this Celestion Speaker Shaper all day. It's been great fun. It's fantastic. So Celestion, for those who don't know, is the manufacturer of speaker drivers for guitar and bass amplifiers, and they are a big name in the business, and a lot of the classic amplifiers are actually running on Celestion speaker drivers on the inside. And Celestion partnered up with SoftTube, which is a Swedish plug-in manufacturer, to model... No, not even model. Well, yes, model, but algorithmically model Celestion speakers. And the cool thing about this is that it's not an IR, it's not impulse response. It's actual algorithmic models of Celestion speakers. So
interesting.
With access to the original Celestion speakers, SoftTube was given like thousands and thousands of profiled data of the response curves and all of this kind of technical stuff that is way beyond me, of the range of Celestion speakers, and old and new, and basically broke down the data into models to figure out how speakers change depending on their construction and their size and their age and the model type and the type of magnets and all of these kinds of things to create an algorithmic model of a speaker simulation, a cabinet simulation, which goes a step further because it's not loading impulse responses. Because it's algorithmic, you can just finally adjust whatever you want. And it's great fun. So one of the tricks that I do a lot, the secret trick, if you ever want to write music that sounds like mine, is that I often put synths and drums through amplifier plugins, like amp plugins. The problem with doing that is that in many cases, I don't want so much coloration, but I really want that kind of that speaker cabinet sound, but I don't really want so much coloration from the preamp and the power amp of a guitar or bass amplifier. And this plugin gives me exactly that, because all it is the speaker simulation. And so it just means that I can have a sound that gets the feeling of it being like reamped through a speaker, but much more fine-grained control over how faithful I want to remain to the original sound, as opposed to, you know, just putting it through, you know, a guitar amp simulator and just hoping that it's going to sound good. I can actually have much more fine-grained control over the effect that the effects that reamping through a speaker would actually have, with a load of different microphone models and microphone positions. And you can buy amps, so you can go to like two speakers at once and then flip the phase to get like really cool effects. And yeah, it's a really, really fun plugin that I see that I'm going to be using a lot.
It looks really fun. Yeah, that is super cool. Because usually when we're thinking about running through amps and speakers, like you were saying, Yeah, it's you're basically just loading these IRs and then, okay, that's cool. And you can play around with that. But it is really cool when you have these things that are modeled and having that super fine grained control over it while also having like super nuanced control over that thing. This looks really cool.
Yeah, it is. And one aspect of it, which I can see myself using a lot, is there's a knob for, I forget exactly what it was called, but I think it's called speaker overload or speaker...
I'm looking at it. It's speaker distortion, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
I was actually looking at that and I thought, oh, you would probably be having fun with that. At least I know I would.
Yeah, and that's a very different kind of distortion. It's not like a... Soft Tube do distortion and overdrive extremely well. And of course, they have their free saturation knob plugin, which is a bit of a classic at this point. That knob is pretty great in this. So I can see myself using that a lot.
Mm-hmm. That looks really cool. All right. Maybe I'll try to buy that. Gosh, I've been trying to buy a few less things since I mentioned that I had recently bought a synth, which means my budget is kind of lower than usual right now. You're really enticing me right now. Darn it.
Yeah, I mean, I think with something like this, though, because it is such a unique proposition, like the concept of it is so unique, I don't know of any other speaker simulator that actually is algorithmic as opposed to just loading IRs and gives you such fine-grained control. So I know of a bunch of amp simulators that have cabinet simulations in them where you get some control, like, you know, move the microphone around or change the model of microphone, but not in the degree that this SoftTube product does. So it really is a unique proposition. So for $39 right now, go on, Vince. You know you want it.
Hold on. Before that happens, you still got to do one last thing, which is bring this episode to a close. So, this was episode 249 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on X at Game Audio Hour, where we post notices about episodes as they drop, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the social media landscape. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember what I just said is to go to gameaudiohour.com. So go ahead and do that while I try not to buy something on this SoftTube sale. Oh gosh, okay. SoftTube.
Said X, Vince. I don't know. Maybe we'll be able to get used to that. You did it.
I know.
You didn't say X, the X-verse, but I don't know. I don't know that I can ever get used to that.
I don't know either. But.